calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And congratulations. Congratulations to the senators who voted no to stopping cloture. You know, we almost got, this is absolutely, frankly, this is absolutely amazing what happened in the United States Senate yesterday and today. And welcome to our program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Radio Show. Tom Hartman here with you. Sam Alito, you know, fairly solid evidence here that this guy would overturn Roe v. Wade, that he would allow race-based discrimination, that he would allow disability-based discrimination, that he'd strike down the Family and Medical Leave Act, that he would authorize support unauthorized strip searches and other massive expansions of police and governmental power, and that he was hostile toward toward legal immigrants and their rights here in the United States. In the face of all of this, the Bi of Indiana, Biden of Delaware, Boxer of California, Clinton of New York, Dayton of Minnesota, Dodd of Connecticut, Durbin of Illinois, Feingold of Wisconsin, Feinstein of California, Kennedy of Massachusetts, Kerry of Massachusetts, Lautenberg of New Jersey, Leahy of Vermont, Levin of Michigan, Menendez of New Jersey, Mikulski of Maryland, Murray of Washington, Obama of Illinois, Reid of Rhode Island, Reid of Nevada, Sarbanes of Maryland, Schumer of New York, Stabenow of Michigan, and Ron Wyden of Oregon all voted to sustain a filibuster against Sam Alito. This is really extraordinary. Even though they weren't successful, consider the fact that a week and a half ago, none of these senators were even talking about this. And as the result of progressive activists out there, by and large, on the internet and on progressive talk radio, because there's not much else. It certainly wasn't in the media. I mean, there was an absolute blackout on this thing in the news media. All the talking heads on TV for the last couple of weeks been going, oh, yeah, Sam Alito, he's a shoo-in. It's going to happen. There's no way around it. You know, blah, 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 blah. There was an absolute full-court press, in fact, from the corporate media, because this guy's a corporatist. This guy is, you know, yeah, GE wants some more defense contracts. Sure. That's right. This guy is, well, he's bad news, and now he's on the Supreme Court. But the fact of the matter is that I view this as a victory. So you got to take your victories where you can as a first step, because we were able to take 25 senators, 24 Democrats and independent Jim Jeffords, and move them from, gee, I guess there's nothing we can do, to I'm going to stand up, and good on them. Now, the United States Senate just voted 58-42 to confirm Alito. Had those 42 no votes also voted to maintain the filibuster, Sam Alito would not be going to the Supreme Court today. And therein lies the hypocrisy, the spread between the no votes on Alito and the yes votes to break the filibuster. And there is a particularly virulent form of hypocrisy there, in my mind. But the other thing that I find interesting, I know in the chat room, I was in the chat room yesterday afternoon as the vote was coming down on the filibuster. And by the way, you can drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com and click live chat and drop in and say hi. I was in there, and it was really interesting because there were some people who were like, you know, ready to slit their wrists with razor blades or something. And I'm saying, no, this is a victory. The fact that these senators stood up. We are in the process, my friends, we are in the process of giving the Democratic Party a spine transplant, finally at long last. And this really, I mean, those who characterize this as, oh, this is terrible, democracy is over, we're all toast, it's, you know, we're doomed. I'm sorry. It's not the case. That is the same mentality as the mentality that says, we're going to have to fight this fight later because we've got to keep our powder dry. It's the mentality of, hey, if you don't win and you don't know that you're going to win in the before you start the fight, then why bother fighting? And I'll tell you why you should bother fighting. You should bother fighting because it is the battle that allows the debate to get out there. The Republicans have not walked away from a fight since, well, go all the way back. I mean, they were fighting fighting Franklin Roosevelt when he was pushing Social Security. You had Republicans on the floor of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives in 1935 and 1936 calling Roosevelt a communist. You had Father Coughlin on the radio, right-wing talk show host, calling Roosevelt a socialist, saying, this is socialism, it's going to be the end of America if we have Social Security. The Republicans got up there and they made their points. And they continue to make their points over and over and over again. And that's how they eventually, that and, you know, a few voting machines and a few shenanigans in a couple of swing states, that's how they ended up in this position of power where they now are, as they say, starting to rather aggressively roll back Roosevelt's agenda. You know Roosevelt's agenda: Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, maximum hours in the workplace protections, the right of workers to unionize. Yes, Roosevelt's agenda. Putting the working man first, and man and woman. But, you know, the cons have a different agenda, right?
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And they did something about that yesterday. They you know, and today. And it was arguably throughout this week and month, and putting Sam Alito on the Supreme Court. But I got to tell you that some Democrats, fortunately, are starting to figure out that it's not just, if we can't win the battle, then why bother, right? There's a lot of Democrats who are starting to figure out that it's more than just that, that they can go the next step, that there's more that they can take out than just that. And, in fact, the other thing we're starting to see is that that people are starting to stand up and say, you know, if there's a Democrat out there who's really a dino, a Democrat in name only, we're going to challenge him. I mean, Joe Lieberman has got this guy, Ned Lamont, crawling up his backside. It looks like Ned is going to take him on in the primary. A lot of people, you know, getting involved in Connecticut, helping Ned out. Joe Lieberman, by the way, voted yesterday to break the filibuster. It's just the Democrats who voted to break the filibuster. These are the Democrats who turned their back on the Democratic Party. Akaka of Hawaii, Baucus of Montana, Binghamton of New Mexico, Byrd of West Virginia. What a tragedy. Cantwell of Washington, Carper of Delaware, Conrad of North Dakota, Dorgan of North Dakota, Inouye of Hawaii, Johnson of South Dakota, Cole of Wisconsin, Landrieu of Louisiana, Lieberman of Connecticut, Lincoln of Arkansas, Nelson of Florida, Nelson of Nebraska, Pryor of Arkansas, Rockefeller of West Virginia, and Salazar of Colorado. And it looks like, you know, many of these Democrats voted no on Sam Alito, but here we are. Ben Nelson, currently no primary challenger, but the citizens of Nebraska, if you're listening, I know that we have listeners in Nebraska. If you are listening right now, you have until the 1st of March to register as a candidate. Bill Nelson in Florida has no primary challenger, but the citizens of the great state of Florida have until May 12th. To put up a challenger to Bill Nelson. Mary Landrieu currently has no primary challenger, but in her state, voters in Louisiana have until August 11th to find an alternative. Maria Cantwell is already being challenged, and rather aggressively challenged, by Mark Wilson in Washington State. In fact, if you go to VoteMark, I believe, .com is his website. I could be wrong about that. VoteMark.org, excuse me. Does Maria Cantwell really represent you? She voted for the Iraq War. She voted for the Patriot Act. She voted for NAFTA. She voted for CAFTA. She voted for the confirmation of Condoleezza Rice. She voted for the confirmation of John Negroponte. She voted to move class action lawsuits from state into federal courts. She voted for the Bush Energy Bill. This on Mark Wilson's website, votemark.org. This is what happens when Democrats start behaving like Republicans. You know, it's what Harry Truman said. When voters are given a choice between a Democrat who behaves like a Republican and a Republican, they'll pick the Republican every time. So what you want to do is you want to get into office, Democrats who behave like Democrats, not like Republicans. And Maria Cantwell in the state of Washington, looking like she might be facing a rather significant challenge. And I'm telling you, this vote is not going to help her at all. In fact, it's going to help her challenger. And ultimately, I think that that's a good thing for the Democratic Party. It's good to shake this party up and wake some folks up. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And I'm here tonight with a detailed report on the economy. Now, many people do not realize that since I have been in office, there has been tremendous growth in one major part of the economy. I'm talking, of course, about the national debt. It has grown tremendously since I've been in office. Now, people don't realize that this is actually a money-saving tactic on my part. See, the way I figure, if we no longer have any money, if we no longer have any wealth as a nation, we can see nothing but tremendous savings. We would no longer need a Department of the Treasury. You're not buying it, are you? Who am I kidding? I got to figure out what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I'm not buying it either.
Now it's gone.
Now the surplus is gone. Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. Truth in Broadcasting. Excuse me, a window just popped up here, and I've got a list of senators. This from RLS Nochel in the chat room. Please don't pop up windows at me in the chat room unless it's an emergency. Akaka in Hawaii, Baucus, these are the Democratic senators who voted to sustain the filibuster, to break the filibuster, and yet voted no on Alito. I mean, this is the hypocrisy. If you don't want Alito to be on the Supreme Court, you vote no, right? Well, then you also filibuster him. Because he's on the Supreme Court now with 58 votes. That's not enough to break a filibuster. So who are the Democrats who were essentially two-faced about this? Akaka of Hawaii, Baucus of Montana, Bingaman of New Mexico, Cantwell of Washington, Carper of Delaware, Chafee of Rhode Island, Domenici of New Mexico, Inouye of Hawaii. Boy, Hawaii's had two senators with a problem there. Cole of Wisconsin, Landrieu of Louisiana, Lieberman of Connecticut, Lincoln of Arkansas, Nelson of Florida, Pryor of Arkansas, Rockefeller of West Virginia, and Salazar of Colorado. Now, I guess at least Robert Byrd was consistent. You know, he was all Alito all the way. Oh, what a sad day. But in any case, the point that I want to make, and it's worth making, and you know, then we'll take your calls at 1-866-440-8466, and you know, your thoughts on this. Let's get this thing worked out. And then I want to get into the State of the Union, what Bush is going to say, and what's reality, and what's going on in the country right now. The bottom line here that we, the progressive movement within the Democratic Party, the progressive movement even exclusive of the Democratic Party, the progressive movement in the United States had a tremendous victory yesterday because 25 senators stood up and did something that a week earlier every political pundit in this country, every newscaster in this country, all the TV talking heads, and frankly, all of the members of the Senate said would never happen. 25 senators stood up and tried to initiate a filibuster. And had there been a little better leadership among the Democrats in the Senate, or perhaps if we'd had a little more time, or, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, we can Monday morning quarterback this thing all day long, but, you know, we might have actually prevailed. But the fact of the matter is we didn't, and we got Sam Alito on the Supreme Court, and that's life. And life will go on, and yes, the Supreme Court is going to swing to the right, and yes, that's not the end of the world. We've been here before in the United States. We were there with the Lochner Court from 1905 to 1937. And you know, the pendulum swings back. The point, though, is that the Democrats got a spine transplant, and I think it was a fine thing. Melissa in, is that Hiddenite, North Carolina?
Hello?
Hello.
Well, this is David from Blaine.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, David. It says you're Melissa. But it's
oh, great to talk to you again. I was just going to quickly say, you know, let them have this judge, because the progressives have bigger fish to fry in what Bush and the Supreme Court judges who selected him in the first place have done since 2000, and the mess that they've created. I mean, the blood is on their hands for selecting him in the first place.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I hope to God that this. And I trust that this will stimulate all the people that don't even vote, you know, that have contributed to this, you know, voter apathy, whatever you want to call it, you know, that's dragging our country down the toilet on one hand, but on the other hand, you know, is, you know, revealing the work that we have to do. I mean, look what happened in the Ukraine. Look what happened in Bolivia. Look what happened in Chile, you know.
In some ways, I got to say this, David, and I know people will, you know, they go nuts when I say it, but it's true. In some ways, George W. Bush was a blessing to us.
Yes.
Because he revealed to us the true face of conservatism, because a lot of the conservative practices that Bush is pursuing, for example, his international policies, particularly his international trade policies, were policies that the DLC Democrats and Bill Clinton were pursuing as well.
Wow.
And I think those policies have been completely discredited now. And, you know, I am, frankly, in retrospect, I think had Al Gore become president, we would have moved in a progressive direction. But now I guarantee you the next Democratic president is, well, I can't guarantee, but I sure hope it's going to be far more of a progressive than what we have right now. David, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, look out, DLC Democrats. This is one of the reasons why I very rarely have these, big shot politicians on this program, because it is so hard to take them on in a debate. I mean, they really don't want to get bruised, and rightfully so. I understand the politics of that. And basically, I would end up having to say, you know, I disagree with you, but if you're representing your constituents, I think that's fine. But frankly, I think a lot of these Democrats are not representing their constituents. I think they're representing the big money interests that are running them, frankly. And just like the Republicans, just like most of the Republicans. Benedict Large notes, 17 of the 19 Democrats who broke the filibuster are DLC and or running in 2006. 89%. Only three DLC Democrats running in 2006 supported the filibuster. Interesting. Speaking of DLC Democrats, Joe Lieberman, Wayne in Bristol, Connecticut. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Great show. I love the show.
Thank you.
Hey, I just really want to call and just say that I'm really so done with Joe Lieberman. Lowell Weicker, former Senator Weicker, is planning on maybe running as an independent just to get rid of Lieberman, and I'll support him if I have to, just to get rid of Lieberman.
Well, and then you got Ned Lamont, who there's folks in Connecticut talking about. He's put up an exploratory site, and people talking about getting him in there and to give Lieberman a run for his money in the primary, which I guess is on May 16th in Connecticut.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm not familiar with him at all. I gotta find out. I gotta find out about him.
Yeah, it's Lamont, Ned Lamont. So, and Lowell Weicker, good guy. He was a Republican, was he not?
He was, and then he was actually an independent governor here in Connecticut. And,
yeah.
And he unfortunately got us our state income tax, which was a bad thing. But he just wants to do it just to get rid of Lieberman too, because it's ridiculous. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Wayne. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Julie in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Julie?
Well, I'm just calling to express an interest in putting, I think that the Democratic senators need to be held accountable for their votes, and I think we should put people up against them in the primaries. If a Republican senator doesn't toe the line, they put somebody right-wing crazy on the primary.
Oh, it's happening. I mean, just check out votemark.org, for example. If you want to see one example of it, there's a guy who's going up against Maria Cantwell in the primaries.
Okay.
And, you know, the incumbency has a lot of advantages. You get a lot of money with incumbency. You get access to power. You know, you get the bully pulpit. You can call a press conference and people show up. And it's not everything. It's not everything. And I think that the Democrats who are not standing up as Democrats, who are not standing up for the principles of this party, of the Democratic Party, and frankly for the principles, the historic principles of America, should be replaced.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just say it just like that. Julie, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Josh in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, a quick tangential question. So I told the screener, remember when Randy Rhodes got in trouble or investigated for that skit that was sort of indirectly threatened the president?
Oh, I remember she apologized for it. I'm not sure that she got in trouble.
But
it was in poor taste.
Yeah, but they proved that these people were listening to her show, right?
Presumably.
So I assume they're listening to us right now and every day. Does that mean I should assume that they're tracking the phone number of me right now?
Josh, in this day and age, given this administration, I would assume that every phone call is being listened in on, that every communication is being monitored. Welcome to the world of Big Brother.
Right. Well, notwithstanding that, I literally think Bush
not to be paranoid, but
right.
You know.
Well, notwithstanding all that, and that Bush is literally the Antichrist. I found in Why America Slept this line when FISA was first passed. It says the covert operators, especially the CIA, complained bitterly that the new restrictions greatly hampered their work, since they often needed some preliminary surveillance in order to uncover sufficient evidence to convince...
Yeah, Josh, instead of reading it to me, tell me what it says.
That was almost done. Probable cause. You can't get probable cause unless you first do covert activities. Now they can't get it.
Well, they can still do... You know, there's still a lot of covert activities that can be done. It's just that there is a certain barrier. It's laid out in the Fourth Amendment that people have the right to be secure in their persons, papers, effects, and homes. I mean, as I recall, let me get the exact language here, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, against unreasonable search and seizure, shall not be abridged except upon probable cause. And,
why is it so hard for folks like you to make this actually stick? To the guy you spoke to yesterday.
What do you mean?
The
conservative who called in?
Somebody who spoke to me yesterday or the day before, and he just kept making all these excuses about they're protecting us, and if he wants to spy on me, that's just fine. I'm not talking to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
You know, we can't make these facts stick. I almost feel like, why even bother to keep talking about it?
Well, because it's important to say. It's just like people back 100 years ago were saying slavery is wrong, and maybe it didn't stick for a while, right? Or 100 years ago they were saying segregation is wrong. 200 years ago they were saying slavery is wrong. You know, 100 years ago they were saying women should have the right to vote. It took a while. Sometimes it takes a while. And of course, there are people on the other side, on the side of corporatism, on the side of unrestrained government power and unrestrained corporate power, who basically, you know, are predators. I mean, they're profiting from this. They're taking the money from Exxon and saying, oh, there's no such thing as global warming, you know, blah, 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 you know, pick your topic, right? And they're just lining their own pockets, their feather in their nest, whatever cliche you want.
Whatever the endless numbers of topics you can talk about, still seems like we're all doomed. I mean, if we can't make things stick and the election fraud stick, why?
We are not only are we not doomed, Josh, we are starting to wake up America. And that's what we saw yesterday, 25 senators standing up, and I guarantee you that if Air America Radio and Jones, with the two larger networks that are syndicating progressive talk radio, and the Internet, the blogosphere, and the progressive websites out there, if none of that existed, none of those 25 senators would have stood. Well, maybe Ted Kennedy would have, but the majority...
Bush reelected proves you wrong. Sorry. I mean, I'm on your side, but that's...
Bush was not reelected.
What's my point? He's in office anyway.
Yeah, so we have to stop that. I mean, the fact that somebody got away with a crime doesn't mean you sit around going, oh, my God, somebody got away with a crime. I guess we'll just give up on trying to stop and trying to enforce the laws.
I guess my bigger point is we need to find some other kind of tactics. What we've been doing, obviously, isn't working.
No, I think what we're doing is working really well, Josh, because we are...
She's in office right now.
Just because you don't win in 5 minutes doesn't mean you stop fighting, Josh.
I'm not saying stop fighting. I'm just saying we need to come up with more creative solutions.
Well, I'm all in favor of as many creative solutions as possible. I'm with you there, and I think, for example, you know, the world can't wait. There's going to be direct action tonight.
It's so
not
silly.
Direct.
That movement is so silly. You're not even offering an alternative. To remove Bush as if he's going to say, oh, they're protesting. I guess that's
well, it's putting out a meme. I think it's a good start, and we've got to start somewhere. Josh, I got to move along. I appreciate your call, and I appreciate your passion, and please continue directing it in appropriate directions. Don in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, what I wanted to mention is you said something about we've seen the true face of conservatism. And my concern is that what we think is conservatism isn't really conservatism. This is the power-hungry Republican Party is the face you're seeing, and it's the very same face that we see with the Democratic Leadership Council. It's a group of people who want to stay in power, and they need corporate money to stay in power, and that's the direction they lean is towards corporatism.
It's interesting, Don, because the Barry Goldwater conservatives, arguably, and I assume that this is the point that you're making, that the Barry Goldwater conservatives, the arguably the John McCain conservatives, are opposed to the expansion of government power. They're opposed to government going into debt, as Bush has. They're opposed to foreign adventurism and wars in foreign places. They're opposed to the expansion of the power of the presidency, traditionally. But I got to say, and that's what I thought conservative always was, too, because, you know, if you're a longtime listener, you know, when I was 13 years old, I thought Barry Goldwater was the guy. You know, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. My dad was a Republican, and I read John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason and thought that's it. You know, 2 years later, I'm out there marching against the war in Vietnam. But when I was 13 years old, that's what I thought was it. And so I have some insight into how the conservatives are thinking. But what I got to say is when you look at the history of conservatism, the Barry Goldwater conservatives are not the real conservatives. What had happened was that the Barry Goldwater crowd had hijacked the phrase, oddly enough. Because if you go back to Sir Edmund Burke back in the late 1700s, who was the father of the modern conservative movement, read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, which is what, you know, got William F. Buckley going. Burke says, he argues in favor of aristocracy. He says that, you know, it should be disguised. The average person should think they live in a democracy, but you can't really trust the governance of a nation to the people. You can't. You've got to have an elite. Now, Burke thought that you should have an elite that was both based on merit, on ability, and based on lineage, because he was British. The conservatives in America think you should have an elite based on wealth, right? A meritocracy.
Right.
You know, those who are smart enough to become millionaires, they're the ones who are entitled to run the country. And whereas the traditional values of America, what are referred to as liberal value, what George Washington referred to as the liberal values of America, are that we, the people, run this country. And that's been the battle between conservatives and liberals forever, you know, and the whole conservatism means elitism. It means the rule of the many by the few, the very wealthy few, the very powerful few. So, you know, there was a time when, a brief time in American history, basically the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, when some conservatives came up, holding on to some traditional American values and calling themselves conservatives, but they weren't the classic conservatives. You're right.
That the Democratic Leadership Council then is more like the new conservative or the real conservative.
That's right.
That's right.
They're sucking up to corporate power. That's absolutely right. The DLC Democrats are classic conservatives in that they are saying that there should be a powerful elite that rules and not the people. Well said. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There is no doubt we're running out of our petroleum. 30 years it disappears, and that is worrisome. So we send the fleet, but drag our feet on renewable energy. Cause God forbid our friends in Texas lose their monopoly. Though solar power would not pollute our water, air, and soil. We'd rather send our troops to war than lose a single drop of oil. We got 4 more years. We just won a majority.
And welcome four back, my friends, to Minimum Daily Adult Requirement of Sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. TomHartman.com. Drop into our live chat room if you'd like. Ryan in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure. What's up?
Hey, I just, you know what? I listen to your show every morning. I consider myself a conservative, yet I don't agree wholly with everything on both sides, obviously. I sit on the fence quite a bit. I do agree with that that statement that's thrown around every once in a while. It says anyone who gives up freedom for a little bit of security doesn't deserve either.
Yeah, to paraphrase Ben Franklin, I think it was.
Everybody gets the idea. But, you know, I keep hearing everybody quote the Fourth Amendment. I know it's quoted on your show quite a bit, how everybody has the right to be secure in their own home unless there is probable cause. I've asked many liberals exactly what they believe probable cause would be. I'm actually just curious about your opinion. I mean, at what point does probable cause warrant, you know, the tapping of individuals' phones?
Well, that's a really good question, Ryan, and the Constitution lays it out very clearly. Somebody's phone can be tapped or somebody's privacy can be invaded when a judge is convinced that an investigator has demonstrated to that judge that there's probable cause to believe that a crime is being committed.
Right.
I mean, so it's up to a judge.
Well, I mean, I don't understand, though. I mean, I hate to keep referring back to 9/11. I mean, I know it's in the past, but it's always, you know, it's always at the foundation of many, many topics today. But, I mean, terrorist attacks, terrorist threats and things like that, I mean, it seems to me that could be ample probable cause for many of these things. I mean, it's not like the government is tapping, you know, my phone at home. I mean, there's no real need to.
How do you know?
But, you know, I totally agree that, you know, I'm getting a little tired of a lot of these issues, you know, especially with the Bush administration and things like that. But it's just hard for me to kind of draw the line as to what probable cause would and would not be. However, I do see, you know, in the statement I did give you, however misquoted it was, that that we are giving up quite a bit of our freedoms for that security.
Yeah, and see, if you get it that the essential point of probable cause is that probable cause is whatever a judge decides it is. And the judiciary, that branch of government is separate from the executive branch of government. It is a check on the power of the executive branch. The executive branch controls the agencies of government that have the ability to investigate. So the Justice Department, the NSA, the CIA, all of them, they operate under the executive branch. They operate under the direction of the president. And there has to be a check on that power, otherwise you end up with a dictatorship. And that check is the judiciary. And that's why it says in the Constitution, in the Fourth Amendment, no warrant, you know, people have the right to be secure, but upon probable cause that it, well, here the exact language again, because it's just, you know, this is just useful to revisit, I think, from time to time, the specific language of it. Where did it go here? Erg. We got some long amendments in here. Ah, here we go. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, here's the problem. The Bush administration is saying, oh, it's all about unreasonable, and we get to decide what's reasonable and not.
Right.
But that's not the case. In any case, against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody has to be willing to swear that they saw or they know something, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. And the reason for this is because, this last part, is because what King George was doing, King George III, I mean, literally back in 1773, what King George was doing was issuing what are called general warrants. He would issue a general warrant where, for example, he would say to his police, you have the right to search anybody anywhere in the city of Boston. And so, you know, our founder said, that's wrong. We don't want general warrants. We want specific warrants. If you think that Joe Blow on 123 Beacon Street in Boston is committing a crime, and you can demonstrate that there's some probability that he's creating a crime, you don't have to demonstrate that he is committing a crime. All you have to show is that there's some probability that he's creating a crime,
right,
and convince a judge of that. That judge will give you a warrant, and you can go tear his house apart.
You know, that does make a lot of sense, you know, if you stick with a specific warrant rather than a general warrant. I mean, if you support the general warrant idea, then that would mean that you are in support of general paranoia being probable grounds, you know, to go out and invade people's privacy.
Well, and that's the point. I mean, what Bush is doing is he's going out here saying 9-11, 9-11, 9-11, which is a general thing, right, and using that to support basically the notion of general warrants, that he should have the right to be able to snoop on anybody he wants, anytime he wants, anywhere he wants, without specifically establishing probable cause that a crime is being committed.
Right.
Ryan, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Chris in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Chris, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm alive and kicking, Chris.
All right, man. I'm just pissed off how I just found out Alito is going to be a new Supreme Court judge.
Yeah, well, you know, things happen, and life goes on. We need to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and keep on walking. We can't lay in the dirt and kick our, you know, beat ourselves over the head with a stick we found nearby. Doesn't work. We've got to move along.
I mean, Roe against, you know, Roe versus Wade is gone now.
Well, not necessarily, but yeah, I think that there's going to be some chipping away at Roe v. Wade. They only have four solid right-wing justices right now: Scalito, Thomas, Alito, and our, you know, Mr. Roberts. There's only four really solid ones. But you know, John Paul Stevens is in his late 80s. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had cancer, and you got Pat Robertson out there praying that she dies. I mean, you know, it's weird stuff going on. So, you know, the battle's not over. I just have to say, Chris, the battle's not over.
The battle's not over because, I mean, I'm a 23-year-old in the South living in Memphis, Tennessee. I know that battle.
And you're awake. Yeah, you've figured out what's going on, and I salute you for that, Chris, and I thank you for your activism and for your participating. And that's the thing. That's why I have so much hope. I mean, the fact that we got 25 senators to stand up on their hind legs and do something is pretty amazing, really, when you think about it. I would suggest that 3 years ago that wouldn't have been possible. And so I really believe that we're moving in the right direction. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. Ken Walsh is the chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Covers the presidency, presidential campaigns, national politics. He's known President George W. Bush since the 1988 presidential campaign, when Bush was a troubleshooter for his father. In 1998, Ken wrote the first News Magazine cover story on then-Texas Governor George W. Bush, in which he described him as a rising GOP star. Ken is the only two-time recipient of the Gerald R. Ford Prize for distinguished reporting on the presidency. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Pleased to have you on here. First of all, I understand in 88 what George W. Bush was doing for his father's campaign was being his liaison with the evangelical community. Am I correct in that recollection?
Yeah, that was one of his big roles, the evangelical community, conservative Christians, by and large. And, he also was a troubleshooter in other ways, you recall. He was the guy who carried the message that John Sununu, his father's chief of staff at the White House, had to leave. So he was sort of the tough guy. He filled that role for his father in those days.
Mm-hmm. Ken, I'm curious. You're a White House correspondent. That's pretty high up the food chain. And Helen Thomas discovered in Bush's first press conference that if you ask this president a hard question, you're going to get slapped down. And I'm assuming you make a pretty good salary, and most White House correspondents do, and that could be a real career killer. How do you deal with that? And what kinds of reforms or changes do you think would be appropriate? Or is this a topic that you can't even talk about, out of concern that such a thing might happen to you?
Yeah, well, I've been covering the White House since 1986, so I've covered four presidents, Reagan, Bush the father, Clinton, and now Bush the son. And there's always been, in my experience, a sense that at the White House, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, that they do get mad at you sometimes, whether you ask a question in a press conference or write a story that they don't like. And that happened with Bill Clinton, and it happened with Ronald Reagan, and it happened with Bush the father, and it happens in particular with Bush the son, because he does get miffed if he feels like, for a number of reasons, not just asking a nasty question or an embarrassing question, but at these press conferences, he doesn't like the idea that the reporters are sort of preening for the cameras and asking long questions just to get their face time on the air. And that's a common thing with presidents. But there is a penalty you pay sometimes for being tough on a president, but in the end, you have to balance out access at the White House with serving your viewers or listeners or readers, and that's the constant challenge that's always been there for covering the White House.
Well, you know, Harry Truman led the investigation into war profiteering in the Roosevelt administration during World War II. He stood up on the Senate floor and said that he believed that there was criminal activity going on inside the White House, that it needed to be investigated, and he led an investigation into Franklin Roosevelt, who then invited Harry Truman to be his vice president.
Right.
You know, a guy who essentially slapped him in the face. Harry Truman invited tough questions from reporters. I remember Jack Kennedy inviting tough questions from reporters. In fact, he was very deft at deflecting them and occasionally turning them into humor. But people were not afraid to ask him hard questions. Do you think that, you know, in 1987, when Reagan set aside the Fairness Doctrine, a good chunk of what he set aside was not just the idea that you have to have both sides of a story on a radio or TV station, but he set aside the doctrine, and then Clinton really nailed this with the Telecommunications Act in 96, that a radio or TV station has to provide public service in order to fulfill their license requirements, and that public service was widely perceived to be, or regarded to be by the FCC, as real news. There's no legal obligation anymore for news organizations, at least in the electronic media, to provide real news. And so that job seems to be increasingly falling to the print media, you guys. At what point do you need the force of law or the force of pressure, like historically reporters had, to not have to, as you said, compromise, but rather to be able to stand up and say, hey, Mr. President, you know, did you just lie to us? Or, you know, has a crime been committed in the White House? Or, you know, it looks, I mean, there's a lot of questions that it seems to me a lot of reporters are just plain old flat out afraid to ask George W. Bush.
Well, I don't think it's quite that dramatic. I mean, first of all, if you look at the whole, you know, run of media relations at the White House, and I've actually written a book about this, so I can talk about this at length if you want to.
What's the book, Ken Walsh?
It's called Feeding the Beast, The White House Versus the Press.
Okay.
And it came out in the mid-90s, and mm-hmm. I did update it with the end of the Clinton administration and Bush. But basically, the idea of presidents getting mad at reporters, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt did understand how to deflect questions, but he also got mad at reporters. There was a case where Franklin Roosevelt actually was so mad at the reporter, he made him wear a dunce cap and put him in the corner of the room he was holding a press conference. Now,
but I'll bet he continued to take his questions.
And the reporter went along with it. He went along and stood in the corner.
Sure.
Now, you can't imagine that sort of thing happening today. But
well, see, there was a good-naturedness about that. Because Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, God bless him, Jack Kennedy, these guys, they all, and even Richard Nixon to a large extent, they all understood that the press, you know, the concept of the Fourth Estate, the concept that the founders talked about, that the press was a balance to the other three branches of government to keep government honest, that the press is the ultimate representative of the people.
Right. Well, I think what's happened recently is a couple of things. One is that this particular White House does not see the press in that constitutional role of serving the country as much as other White Houses have. In fact, there's some sense in this White House that they see the media as another commercial enterprise, that the transmitting of information through the media to the country is a commercial transaction that will help boost the bottom line of a media corporation by increasing ratings or increasing circulation or whatever. It's quite a different philosophy of dealing with the media than we're used to, and that I think is appropriate. So that's one problem. Another problem is that we have lost a lot of our are clout with the American people in the mainstream media. And that's a long discussion, but basically, but when dealing with the White House, we don't have as many cards to play as we used to because the country is not paying as much attention to the media, to the mainstream media. There's a fracturing in the mainstream media, and there's all the alternative media now. There's, you know, the internet and bloggers and so on. And plus, another factor is the divided America. So people are looking to have their views sustained in the media, as the country did during the partisan press era of the 19th century. And so with all these factors, it makes it a different media environment at the White House. And the idea of being tough with the president, well, if you look at the press conferences and if you look at Scott McCullough's briefings every day, he's the press secretary, of course, at the White House. He is beaten up constantly at this
point. Oh, yeah, but getting tough with Scotty is a whole different thing than getting tough with George W. Bush. We're talking with Ken Walsh. He's the chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And, Ken, there is only one industry, only one spectrum of business that the founders saw fit to carve out a niche for in the Constitution of the United States, and that's the press. It's in the First Amendment. It is the only industry that's mentioned by name in the entire Constitution. And it just strikes me as odd that this administration would think that, oh, the press, they're just another business, you know, blah de blah. And that, frankly, a lot of people in the press, I think that it's just another business. I mean, I'm watching on CNN, increasingly, their coverage is not about what's really news. It's about, you know, a white girl missing in Aruba, a dead guy on a cruise ship, and, you know, the histrionic stuff. And it just...
Well, yeah, that's...
What do we do about this?
I think that has much less to do with politics than about simply the infotainment culture that we're in, that the mix between the entertainment value of stories or the perception.
Yeah, I agree, and we only have about a minute left, Ken, but how do we break that? How do we change that?
Well, I'm a reporter, not a pundit, and my feeling about this is, and again, what I've written about in this book is I have an extensive critique of the media, which we can talk about another time since we're running out of time now, but basically, I think we have to get back to first principles in the media, and reporters should be reporters. They should not be pundits trying to take position or sort of show their willingness to zing people all the time. And I think that the pundits should continue to do what they're doing, but I think there has to be a diversity in people's approach to the media. You can't get a full range of news and information from one media source anymore, no matter what it is. So I would encourage people you have to have a range of accesses to the media, and then make your own judgment. But I think a key point is reporters need to be as straight as possible and let the pundits do whatever they do, and there should not be, I think, a breakdown of that barrier between the two.
Good point. Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
USNews.com, by the way, the website. And Ken, once again, the title of your book was?
It's Feeding the Beast.
Feeding the Beast. Great. Ken, thanks a lot. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no!
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Yes, and the storm looks like it's about to hit here. I'll tell you, something sure hit the fan yesterday in the United States Senate. 25 senators standing up and saying no to the Bush media, even knowing that it was a futile gesture, they stood up and said no. I'm impressed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Tom. Yeah, it definitely was an impressive thing. I mean, the attempt by Kerry and Kennedy to filibuster is being called chaotic in the Washington news, but I don't think that really matters to those who thought it was an important thing to do.
Yeah, for sure. This was, I think, a very noble attempt. And frankly, I think had it not been for the Internet and for Progressive Talk Radio, there wouldn't have been one senator standing up.
Really?
Yeah, I am. I think that we succeeded in mobilizing the base, the progressive base in America, of and increasingly what these senators are realizing is average Americans to say, hey, wait a minute, we do care about Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, we do care about a woman's right to choose, we do care. You know, these are issues that we actually do care about. And I think, you know, maybe Ted Kennedy would have gotten on his horse like Don Quixote, you know, with his sword out there or his spear to go out after a windmill. But I don't think anybody would have followed him. We had 25 senators. That's more than just the people running for president.
Yeah, it definitely was more than just people running for president. Oh, yeah. Please God, there isn't a field of 25. That would be insane.
Yeah. No, it's and so I think that this is, I just see it as a tremendous victory, even though Sam Alito is now in the Supreme Court, and even though the Republicans, the conservatives, can reliably count on four hard right members of out of the nine on the Supreme Court right now. And, you know, let's all pray for the health of the remaining Supreme Court members for the next 3 years, because you know, another one would be, that would tip the balance. But although the balance is precarious as it is, what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now?
Well, we've got this little thing tonight, you know, this event. We have the State of the Union speech at 9:01 being delivered by the president. In fact, I'm on my way to the Capitol now, because it's my excitement and delight to cover this thing, and I'll be in the Capitol for some considerable time. Once you're in the Capitol, you don't get out. They have a lockdown.
You're kidding.
If you're in, you're in, and if you're out, you're out. And it's as simple as that. It'll happen around 5:30, and once I'm in, I'm in.
Hmm, interesting.
So it is. It's very interesting, and the security is quite extraordinary. So that's, frankly, Greenspan retiring and Bernanke coming in, the Alito vote, they're the other stories. And, of course, Alito, that they voted to confirm, and also that he will be in the audience tonight will be a piece of it. But really, the only story in Washington, I can tell you, is the State of the Union and the Democrats' response. Now, Governor Tom Kaine of Virginia appeared on a radio show earlier this morning, and he was talking about his response, which he says will be about 9 minutes. And he's saying he's going to be talking about results and about how in Virginia they've got results. And he's not only going to be critical of the president, which he doesn't tend to be, but he says he's going to offer forward actual solutions.
That's marvelous. So we'll see how it shakes out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria, for the report from Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.
TalkRadioNews.com. Great speaking with you today. And carry on. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Grace in East Sound, Washington, on the line. Hey, Grace, welcome to the program. Oh, maybe not. Maybe if Grace is online, too, if you can pop her on.
Hello.
Grace? Hey, Grace, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I love you, Tom, and I love your program, but, boy, you really shocked me today.
How so?
Well, I'm wondering whether you're a stealth Republican, because you took off against our state senator here in Washington, Maria Cantwell, and promoted the Republican candidate who is a retired executive from Safeco Insurance, another big business buddy.
Mark Wilson is a Republican?
Oh, well, yes. That's why he's running against, I'm not sure his name is Mark Wilson, but...
No, the one I was quoting was Mark Wilson, who is the Democrat running against her in the primary.
Well, Mark, there was somebody...
As a Democrat. He's a Democrat. He's definitely a Democrat. It's votemark.org.
Oh, God.
And his platform...
You were promoting this. It started with an M, too, the guy who...
No. Mark Wilson, if you just go to votemark.org, you'll get it. And his platform is to bring an immediate end to our nation's ill-conceived, costly adventure in Iraq. I'm looking at his website right now. Protect Social Security, oppose NAFTA, CAFTA, and the WTO, and repeal Taft-Hartley. Direct 50% of weapons spending to conversion from fossil fuels to renewable energy, which will build bridges to peace while creating jobs, refocus our troops on national defense, enforce air and water quality standards, establish a national peace academy, support basic education K through age 20, end the tragic, costly, and misguided war on drugs, and make sure health care becomes the right of all Americans. And those are all positions that Maria Cantwell's not taking.
Tom, you know and I know that big money talks, and what we've got in the state of Washington running for the Senate this year is the incumbent Maria Cantwell, the Democrat, and the Republican, the big money Republican. And what I hear you advocating, in fact, with the other senators you quoted around the country who are.
What I'm saying, Grace, I'm sorry we're out of time, but what I'm saying is if Maria Cantwell makes it through the primary, and if a more progressive candidate is not fielded by the Democrats, then I will support Cantwell's candidacy, because a weak Democrat is better than even a progressive Republican right now. But if she doesn't make it through that primary and Mark Wilson is there, I think he'd make a great senator. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
High and low, all must go, heart to the shout of war. Leave to the women the harvest yield. Gird ye men for the sinister field. A saber instead of a scythe to yield. War, red war.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. And that's, you know, one of our slogans, and it's also the key to this whole thing. For a long time I thought my strategy, as it were, the position on this program was I am not going to wound any Democrats because they are becoming an endangered species. And so I'm not going to pick on any Democrats. I'm not going to criticize any Democrat. That's an overstatement. But I'm not going to go to the point that might wound a Democrat, because then a Republican might get into office. And I'm realizing that that's not the best strategy. The best strategy is to hold their feet to the fire. And then, you know, when it comes down to the election support. So, for example, because the reason why, by the way, is because the first vote that a member of Congress or a senator makes is their most important vote. That's their vote for leadership. Whichever party, because of the winner-take-all nature of our system and because the rules of the House and the Senate, whichever party controls the House, whichever party controls the Senate, makes the rules for the House and the Senate and decides what's going to come up for a vote and that kind of thing. And so being a majority party in one or the other of those two bodies is, and ideally both, but in one or two of those other bodies, is absolutely essential. And so, for example, to use Cantwell as example, we could just as easily use Lieberman with the challenges that are being Nolan, the challenges that are being mounted against him, and a number of other Democrats who may be having challengers, or the situation in Pennsylvania, for example, where Chuck Pinocchio is going up against, you know, a big name Democrat. Essentially a DLC Democrat, a Democrat who says that he's pro-life and he's pro-NAFTA and he's pro-CAFTA and he's pro-corporate, basically. And Chuck Pinocchio is the progressive. And opednews.com just paid for a poll to have the Zogby organization go into Pennsylvania, a good, straight, stand-up poll by Zogby. And when they said, okay, this, you know, we're going to have a Democrat who's going to run against Arlen Specter, or against Ricky Santorum. And what do you think? And the big-name Democrat came out on top. He has name recognition. Then they went through and they said, okay, now here are the candidates' positions. And all of a sudden, Chuck Pinocchio is more easily beating Rick Santorum than the big-name Democrat had been. I think progressives are a force in this country, and the Democratic Party hasn't figured it out. And fielding some progressives against sellout Democrats in primaries, even if they don't win, is a good way to put them on notice. And then, you know, if the progressives don't win, if you've got a lukewarm Democrat, so be it. We still have to support them because the Republican Party is so corrupt that it's like having the mafia run the country. But we still hold their feet to the fire. We still hold them accountable, and we still say, as I say today to Maria Cantwell, I know that when you voted no against Alito today, but you voted yes yesterday to break the filibuster, you were doing so thinking that in November you can go to the voters and say, oh, I voted against Alito. And that kind of hack politics just isn't going to make it in America anymore. Paula in Eureka, California. Hey, Paula. Welcome to the program. Thanks for listening, KGOE.
Listen, I'm one of those people that got the 888-355-3588 number from you, and I called like 20 senators last Friday and Monday. I was so upset, and this morning I got on and I heard what happened, but then you again were able to turn it somewhat into a positive and to say, you know, look, at least a couple of weeks ago we didn't even have the 25.
We didn't even have John Kerry. I mean, it was a progressive website 5 days ago, 6 days ago, that found John Kerry's 2003 speech where he said that if the Republicans put forward a candidate for the Supreme Court who was going to knock down Roe v. Wade, he would lead a filibuster. And they waved that in his face, and all of a sudden he realized, well, okay, I guess I got to do it.
Exactly. And so, you know, I did call like 20 people and I was very upset. But then when I heard your earlier caller saying that he'd heard that Senator Kerry was getting grief, I thought, you know, let's turn this around the way Tom is doing, and let's call that number and let's flood those phone lines for those 25 and let's give them a hand.
You're right.
You know, let's do
You're
that.
Absolutely
and so
right,
I
Paul.
Did. I called Senator Kerry's office and I said, I bet you were really busy. And the lady was, yes, we were. I go, well, I was just calling back to say thank you, and I hear he's getting some grief. And she said, yes. And I go, well, the 42, I go, it was possible. And she said, yes. And I said, well, you know, at least he tried. And so I don't think that they're really expecting people to call back and give them the positive and say thank you. And I think that's just as important as going against the negative. So if everyone who called and was so upset would call that number that you gave out and just support those that did, I think that going into tonight's nightmarish State of the Union address, it gives them some, you know, something, you know, give them on the both sides, the negative and the positive, at least.
You're absolutely right, Paula. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, and very well said. Thank you.
And thank you for all you do. Love it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Paula.
Bye.
I appreciate the call. And you know, in California, that would be calling Barbara Boxer. In Washington State, it would be calling Patty Murray. I mean, I'll have to find a list here in just a second. But, you know, who do you call and say thank you? The people who voted to break the filibuster, the 25 Democrats who voted to break the filibuster. Mike in Celebration, Florida. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I need your input on something here, on this wireless, this warrantless wiretaps.
Mm-hmm.
It's my opinion that they're kind of, and nobody's ever talked about this, or maybe people have thought about it, but it's kind of like setting us up for a 1-2 punch with the Patriot Act. If you had a theory being that if an unscrupulous bunch of people in power decided to do a wireless, a warrantless wiretap on you, and they found out that you were so-called political enemy, then they could say, well, seditious talk, and then they could arrest you under the Patriot Act. And when you get arrested, you say, on what cause? And they say, we don't have to. It's in violation of the Patriot Act. And where did you get your information? A wiretap. Well, we didn't need any permission for a wiretap on
right. That. And you're an enemy combatant, so it's off to the concentration camp with you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is,
we've seen this movie before, Mike. We've seen it in Chile. We saw it in Argentina. We saw it in Germany. We saw it in Spain. We saw it in Italy. And, you know, now George Bush would like to bring it to a theater near you and me. And I don't think America's going to go for it. I don't think we're going to buy it.
Well, I don't think they would, but I don't think a lot of Americans realize how that could be like a 1-2 punch for political enemies.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike, and people need to be waking up, and they need to be waking up fast. Thanks for calling and making that point. Here are the Democrats who voted to sustain the filibuster. These are the good guy Democrats, the ones who voted to hold a filibuster. Chaotic or not, Bi of Indiana, Biden of who I'm a frequent critic of, but nonetheless, God bless him. Bi of Indiana, Biden of Delaware, Boxer of California, Clinton of New York, Dayton of Minnesota, Dodd of Connecticut. These are the good guy Democrats, the ones who voted to sustain a filibuster. The only way to truly prevent Alito from getting on the court. Durbin of Illinois, Feingold of Wisconsin, Feinstein of California, Kennedy of Massachusetts, Kerry of Massachusetts, Lautenberg of New Jersey, Pat Leahy in Vermont, Levin in Michigan, Menendez in New Jersey, Mikulski in Maryland, Murray in Washington, Obama in Illinois, Reid in Rhode Island, Reid in Nevada, Sarbanes in Maryland, Schumer in New York, Stabenow in Michigan, and Wyden in Oregon. And if you heard your senator's name there, give them a call toll-free at 888-355-3588 and say, thank you for a job well done. You know, we didn't win the battle, but you at least fought it. Thank you. God bless you. Andy in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hi, I'm calling about the Senator Cantwell's vote for cloture yesterday.
Right. Vote to break the filibuster, in other words. Yeah.
Exactly. As far as I'm concerned, that's the same as voting yes on Justice Alito.
Certainly.
And I contacted her office an hour before the vote, and I was assured by them that she wouldn't vote for cloture. And she went ahead and did it anyway. So great to hear about this other guy running in the primaries out here, and my wife and I plan on working for him this year.
Yeah, it's a vote, Mark. We're going to get him on the air here and find out what he has to say for himself. I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe the guy's maybe he's flaky, maybe he's not. We'll find out. But I know that Maria Cantwell has some primary opposition, I'm not saying that she's terrible. I don't want to take her down. The last thing I want is for her to be so wounded that a Republican will beat her in the general election. Okay, but I really think that the audience that I'm talking to right now gets that. And we'll support her if she wins in the primary, and if she has an opposition in the primary. Hopefully that will help her figure out that there are progressives out there who are also among her constituents, and in fact may probably make up the majority of her constituents, at least on the Democratic side. Andy, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Great show.
Good talking with you. Dave in Eureka, California. Dave, we have less than a minute. What's up?
Well, Tom, I think we have to assume that these cons fully intend to hold on to the power of their offices, and they tend to do it by cheating, and they're hanging on to these machines, and it worries me very much. I think even if the popularity of the Republicans gets down to 35%, they'll be able to swing it where they have these machines, and people say, well, the public would never live with that. But I got to ask, what could we do then?
Oh, I think the public already has. I am convinced that in Georgia, in 2002 election, that Max Cleland won that election. I mean, here's Saxby Chambliss, a guy who was a Vietnam draft dodger, running against a guy who lost three limbs in Vietnam, claiming that Max Cleland was not sufficiently patriotic. The polls showed Cleland with 53, 54, 55% of the vote the day before the election, which is the exact margin by which he lost. I think that vote was flipped. There's not a single paper trail in the entire state of Georgia from that election. It's impossible to audit it. And I am concerned about it too, Dave. And hopefully something will be getting done as we educate more and more people. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again.
Welcome back, my friends.
I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
Sometimes you just have to take a break, you know? Sometimes you got to catch your breath. You know, the general madness happens. We're going to have the State of the Union speech tonight, all this stuff, you know, just general madness all around. And yet, occasionally we need to just step back, take a deep breath, and say, you know, we're still here. We're still here. There's a lot of work to do. We're still here. And we're going to sit on the dock of the bay for a few minutes. Or we're just going to, you know, watch Tom DeLay implode.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
As in an interview to be aired tonight on Hardball with Chris Matthews, Tom DeLay tells Chris that his constituents are, quote,
very, very supportive
of his candidacy.
And they know what Ronnie Earle is, a runaway district attorney who is abusing his power, indicting me on laws that don't exist. The backlash is in my favor,
says Tom DeLay. A recent Houston Chronicle poll, however, tells a different story. This is from the Houston Chronicle. A criminal indictment and continuing investigations have severely eroded support for U.S. Representative Tom DeLay in his district. Only half of those who cast ballots for DeLay in 2004 said they will do so again. And while a fourth of the 2004 delayed voters aren't sure whom they will vote for this year, almost 20% have defected to other candidates. DeLay may be able to win back the undecided voters, but he starts with the disadvantage of a 60% unfavorable rating in the district he has represented for 20 years. Only 28% view him favorably, according to the polls. Not that different from George W. Bush, when you think about it. What can I say? Sam in, is it Candigua, New York, Sam?
Yes.
Hey, Sam, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Is this Tom?
It is. You're on the air.
I'm sorry. I'm only picking you up over the phone. They're not broadcasting you here at this time. My point is, isn't it kind of funny that all these Republicans that are voting for Alito and want the intelligent design in schools and everything, they're also having all these big problems with what happens if the mullahs get in control of Iraq?
Yeah, it is. What it shows you is that they're in favor of theocracy as long as they're the theocrats.
Exactly. And I don't understand how they feel that would be a good thing for America, but, you know, for...
Well, they're not going to have any say over it.
...where they actually want this.
See, Sam, the Bush administration thought they could control this thing. They thought they had it nailed down in the very beginning, and they were going to have these caucuses where people came in and they would, sort of like Iowa, the Iowa Democratic primary caucuses, where people would come in and they'd, you know, offer their opinions and they'd have discussions, and then, and they would handpick. The Bush administration was going to handpick who would be in the caucuses. So you could pretty much predict what the outcome would be. And this was Paul Bremer's idea, and, you know, let's do it like that. In fact, the reason Paul Bremer came in and replaced the guy before him was because the guy before him had called for elections. And so, you know, the Bush administration was like, we don't want no stinking elections. And Sodder, remember Sodder, Sodder City, Sodder, the guy whose militia killed Cindy Sheehan's son? Sodder goes out in the streets and says, no, we want elections. And Sistani, the other Ayatollah there and the other religious leader among the Shiites in Iraq, says, yeah, we want elections. And millions of people poured into, or hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets and said, we want elections. And so the Bush administration was backed into a corner. And so they said, okay, we've got a great idea. How about you guys have elections? And then Bush started running around going, yeah, democracy, it's a fine thing. We're going to give them elections. All the while, the professional diplomats at the State Department going, uh-oh. And sure enough, now we have a country, Iraq, that has signed a mutual defense agreement with Iran. Not unlike World War I, you know, where all these European countries had mutual defense agreements with each other. So when Archduke Ferdinand got assassinated in Sarajevo, then, you know, this just triggered this domino falling effect. Now, I mean, we've got this very strange situation, where if we invade Iran, Iraq has pledged to go to their defense. I mean, go figure. Ron in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Howdy. I think there's definitely things for Democrats and, you know, conservatives, libertarians, or true conservatives to be positive about. First of all, everybody's kind of wondering at this State of the Union stunt that Bush is doing tonight, whether Bush's paramour, Jeff Gannon, the male blah, 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 is going to be in the audience, the guy with 196 visits.
You don't really think he was Bush's paramour.
Yeah. I'm
guessing it was either Karl Rove or Scotty McClellan.
Bush is definitely one of them. In college, he was involved with that type of activity. Let me get on to more normal.
We could do a CNN Rita Cosby thing here, you know, and talk about sex. It seems to help the ratings of CNN.
But this is the family values crowd, you know? Or is it really the Brokeback values crowd?
Well, you got Ken Melman, who's the head of the Republican National Committee, you know, running ads on gay websites saying that he's looking for casual sex.
Ken Melman, Grover Norquist, Rove, you know, David Dreyer. You know, what they have in common with Truman Capote and Liberace, you know, it's crazy that they're claiming Christianity and the Bible and the whole nine yards, the purported Christianity.
Well, actually, it's crazy that they're attacking homosexuality because, you know, I don't see Christianity as essentially being anti-gay. Jesus never attacked homosexuality. Nowhere in the New Testament is there an attack.
I don't want to debate that. I think conservatives and true conservatives and liberals have enough in common that I think, you know, as in 2005, Democrats, and, you know, we just won pretty big.
We need to get together and take our country back, Ron.
Yeah, and
we really do. We need to get together and take our country back. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry we're out of time here. But it is the stakes are getting higher and higher, as we just saw with Sam Alito. One more Supreme Court justice, and these guys will have a court that will look like the court did in 1905. And yeah, the country survived that, But, you know, it brought us the Great Depression. Thank you very much. The Republican Great Depression. We really would rather not have that again. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Time for our Bioneers guest for the week. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website. And Akilah Sherrills is with us. Akilah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Glad to have you on. In 1989, after seeing 13 of your friends killed in a bloody gang war in Watts, you brought together a group of people so that in 1992, you and your brother brought together the Bloods and the Crips to sign a peace treaty?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What happened with that?
Well, you know, it was, I would say that it was truly a spiritual experience. You know, myself, my brother, a group of other key individuals in the neighborhood, you know, for years, you know, we had watched the conditions in the community kind of create this psychosis of gang violence in a certain sense, in which, you know, over the past 20 years in L.A. County alone, it's claimed over 15,000 lives.
Wow.
And that's not even...
That's more than Iraq.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a war zone. I mean, the kids and the adults in these communities suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and hypervigilance, and because... you know, places like Watts is not, you know, outside of this country. There's no peace envoys. There's no humanitarian aid to help the kids and the adults deal with the after effects of war. You know, so it's actually just, it's allowed in a certain sense to just keep happening and just keep spinning out of control.
And Watts is one of many communities in the United States facing these kinds of problems.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we did was we came together and decided that we were the only ones that could actually bring an end to it. With the support of Minister Farrakhan doing the Stop the Killing Tour in 1989, and then Jim Brown, a partnership that we formed with him, created AmeriCan. We developed this 15-chapter self-esteem life skills curriculum that kind of became the basis of a new conversation in which we decided that we were going to take responsibility for our actions and begin to solve our problems differently amongst each other. And, you know, over the years, 11 years we did that, you know, the peace treaty truly changed the quality of life in the neighborhood. I mean, you know, grandmothers began to walk the streets again, kids began to play in the parks again. I mean, it was, you know, unbelievable. And it created a domino effect all across the country, giving birth to what we believe to be one of the most significant events in the 20th century, which was the Million Man March. Over 2 million African-American men came together from all across the country to atone for the negatives that they had perpetrated against themselves and also against the communities that they lived in. And, you know, so, you know, since then we've been, you know, moving forward in that vein. I mean, you know, we now believe that Watts is the catalyst for the next page of peace movement in this country because places like Watts, and not only Watts, actually, it's Watts is a microcosm of what's taking place in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we believe is that we're never going to get rid of gangs in a certain sense. You know, the negative aspect of so-called urban street gangs, it's about maybe 0.1%. So out of 500 cats who consider themselves gangsters from Grape Street, the neighborhood I'm from, it's only about 5 individuals are actually out there doing all of the negative activities, and that's getting all of the media and all of the play.
Well, Akilah Sherrills, isn't, and by the way, is wattsrecords.com a website where people can find out more about this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Don't you think that at a certain level, being a member of a gang satisfies just a very fundamental human need to be part of a community, to be part of a tribe, to be part of a, you know, to have some sense of, you know, I'm in this with somebody else?
Absolutely.
So how do you turn that into a positive?
Well, the gang is a surrogate family, as you just spoke to, you know, and instead of trying to dismantle this group, you know, let's instill the morals and values within the structure and keep it intact. So we believe that, you know, like I said, only a small percentage of these individuals are actually violent. You know, many of them are coming together because they lost their nuclear family to the real killer, which is poverty. So, you know, we believe that we can facilitate a conversation with the key players in these neighborhoods and redefine, or define, rather, the unwritten rules of the streets amongst those individuals. So it becomes a new covenant in which they live by. And then, you know, then we bring in all of the other skills, the leadership skills. You know, they're already natural leaders. The thing is they just don't know how to lead from the inside out. They need that type of guidance.
You've created the Community Self-Determination Institute in 1999. This is what's doing this. But in 2004, you suffered a tragedy in your own family.
Yes, sir. Yes, I lost my oldest son, to this senseless violence on the street. And, it called to something very deep in me, in which I had to ask that question about, you know, really, like, what's the gift in this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be about the hardest thing. I mean, I'm the father of three children. I can't imagine one of them being murdered. I mean, it's just, I can't even let myself go there. That had to have been a terrible experience.
Yeah, man. I tell you this, you know, it's, I'm positive that I suffer from this same, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, stuff growing up in the neighborhood. You know, that I'm emotionally desensitized to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. You know, although, you know, I would say that I'm an exception to the rule, you know, from a lot of the folks that I grew up with in the neighborhood.
Well, it sounds like you're a very resilient person, you know, psychologically you're fairly healthy. I mean, you've started this new thing called the Reverence Movement, in part as a result of your son Terrell being murdered?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about that.
Well, the Reverence Movement, it's an idea. You know, reverence is about the quality of attention that we give to someone or something. I believe also that the Reverence Movement is the convergence place of all of the movements in the past. So whether it's human rights or civil rights or environmentalism or, you know, social justice, at their base, at their root, there's a need to restore the vitality of the human spirit. Mm. Because I believe that if we can't imagine ourselves, you know, in future, you know, with our enemies, our so-called enemies, playing a different type of role, then we're fooling ourselves. If we keep on creating this us and them thing, I think that, you know, it's going to actually cause a civil war in this country. So, you know, this Reverence Movement is about exposing the heart. It's about finding a way to tell the things that we covered in our heart, the secrets, you know. And I like to, you know, lead off by telling my story, because I know when you expose something deep within yourself, it gives others permission to do the same. So I always tell the story of being, you know, abused, molested as a kid by my older brother, and how this caused so many challenges in my life, and I really didn't know how, you know, the different ways in which it affected me until I actually released it. Mm-hmm. When I finally let it go, it seemed like my whole life opened up. I couldn't question anything in my life, all the things that were going around me, because it first meant to question, you know, that, you know? And
There's a lot of power in letting go of things and walking away from them.
Yes, sir.
Akilah Sherrill's wattsrecords.com, the website, the Reverence Movement. You're working on this Ashes and Snow Nomadic Museum now?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about it. We've got about two and a half minutes left here.
The Ashes and Snow Nomadic Museum is it's an expedition that was that features 150 large-scale photographs taken by Gregory Colbert, who's a Canadian photographer that did these 30 expeditions around the world. And took pictures of animals and man communing in these different environments. And the images, the films, they're so unbelievable, Tom. Man, I feel like, you know, it totally resonated with me. Paul Hawkins, who many of you know, actually bought me in on the project. When I saw the images, I was just so moved. I was like, I have to be involved with this. Yeah. One of the roles that I'm playing as the manager of the exhibit is that I set up a staffing company in which we, you know, hired over 60 people from the surrounding communities to be employed. And, you know, Paul, you know, Gregory, these are extremely generous individuals. I mean, they're paying all of the individuals living wages. We're bringing 160,000 kids from L.A. County for free, you know, providing the buses and the tickets for K-12. I mean, it's, you know, man, this is a dream, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, so blessed to be able to, you know, work with amazing people, you know, who have real integrity and who really see, you know, that this is a collective movement that has to bear on the circumstances that we experience every day in the communities in which we live.
Yeah, Akilah Sherrill's wattsrecords.com. Very quickly, you mentioned Malcolm X at one point, but you're sounding much more like Dr. Martin Luther King, whose wife just passed on today. God bless her, Coretta Scott King. Do you see that transformation happening in urban America?
Absolutely. I see the transformation happening. Unfortunately, it's going to get a little worse before it actually gets better, because I believe that, you know, and death is not such a bad thing. It's our perception of it that,
yeah,
that really is the problem. So, you know, I think that that things are getting it's really bad in the neighborhood right now. You know, but there's a lot of good things. You know, this Asherton Snow Nomadic Museum is one. You know, Watch Records. You know, we produced an album that we consider to be theme music for the movement. Hip-hop,
mm-hmm.
R&B, jazz, gospel, inspirational music. It's an amalgamation of everything. So, you know, anybody that goes out and purchases the album, I guarantee you that you'll be satisfied.
You'll be inspired.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and this really ultimately has to be, we have to have inspiration here. And we've got to get some political action, too, to deal
right.
with the problems of poverty in the United States. So you can't, you know, people run around and they say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And there's so many people who don't have bootstraps, you know?
Exactly.
We got to have a starting point here. Akila Sherrills, wattsrecords.com, the website. Thanks so much, Akila, for
Thank
being with
so
us
much,
today.
Tom.
Great speaking with you, and keep up the good work, my friend. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, summer, come out tomorrow. Bet $1 million that tomorrow we'll have won. Just shave off that beard, no bristle, 'cause we've got a new beard-seeking missile. It's no fun. The U.S. of A. has ways to find you. We've got a new tag, so watch your back. Oh, there's one thing that's more obnoxious than a germ-filled baggie of smallpoxes to attack.
Osama, yes, it'll be 22 minutes past the hour. Boy. Lenders try to keep mortgage boom alive. This from the Wall Street Journal today, I believe. An article by Ruth Simon. Hoping to ride a new wave of profits as the mortgage boom winds down. Now, here, the lenders, the banks and the mortgage companies out there, first they made a pile of money saying, hey, you should roll over your fixed rate mortgage for an adjustable rate mortgage because you can get a lower rate and your monthly payments will be lower. Well, now the Fed has been cranking up interest rates. And so now they're coming out and they're saying, hey, don't you want to lock in interest rates before they go even higher? You need to get a fixed rate mortgage. And every time they get to sell you a mortgage, they get to pull a couple $1,000 out of you. So this, as Ruth Simon writes, hoping to ride a new wave of profits as the mortgage boom winds down, lenders have changed course and are targeting borrowers with adjustable rate mortgages and encouraging them to refinance into fixed rate loans. Yeah. A lot of folks looking at that. Well, see, the problem with that is that that's not going to maintain this economy. I mean, this economy is being held together with the spit, bubblegum, and baling wire. The only reason that we are not in a Great Depression right now is because it is being masked by the fact that George W. Bush is borrowing $2 billion every single day. And actually more than that. You know, the numbers that the Bush administration reporting, 300 and some odd billion dollars for the deficit, doesn't include the more than $200 billion that he's borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund this year. And it doesn't include the $50 to $80 billion that he's going to ask Congress for another year of Iraq. So we're really looking at a deficit of around $600 to $700 billion. That's $3 to $4 billion a day I think. Let's see. No, 6 to 7. Yeah, that would be. We're right back to $2 billion. Yeah, 365 days in a year. So more or less $2 billion a day. We're still borrowing $2 billion. And then on top of that, you've got a trade deficit of $2 billion of $600 billion to another $2 billion a day. So here we are borrowing all this money. It's the same thing. I remember saying this when Reagan was president, and we first, you know, Reagan came into office and he did his tax cuts. He took the top marginal tax rate from 70%. It used to be that if you earned $50,000 a year in today's dollars, you know, you'd pay 20-30%. You earned $80,000, you'd pay 30-35%. You earned $100,000, you'd pay 35-40%. You earned $200,000-$300,000, it goes up to around 45-50%. You get it into the point where you're earning $4-5 million a year, you start getting hit with a 70% tax rate. And Kennedy had lowered it from 90% to 70%, but he closed up enough loopholes that it actually increased the revenue coming into the federal government. Kennedy actually increased income taxes by closing loopholes. And was unambiguous about it. I mean, he came right out and said it over and over again. So anyhow, here we have Reagan dropping income taxes like crazy on the wealthy in the United States. And as a result, and he thought, you know, this was going to increase the revenue coming into the government, right? It didn't. Instead, what it did is it created a huge deficit. Ronald Reagan, in his 8 years in office, spent more money, borrowed more money and spent it than every president combined in the history of the United States, including the money that we borrowed to fight World War II, including the money that we borrowed to fight World War I, including the money that we borrowed to fight the Civil War, including the money we borrowed to fight the War of 1812, and including the money we borrowed to fight the Revolutionary War, most all of which has been paid back by now. But now George W. Bush doing the same thing. And I used to say back during the Reagan era, give me a credit card with $1 trillion, and I'll show you a good time. Particularly one that my children are going to have to pay the interest on. And this year, we're going to pay $160 billion in interest on Ronald Reagan's credit card. We're still paying for Ronald Reagan. You know, he crashed us into a recession, the Reagan recession, and then sort of brought us out of it by borrowing. And that's what Bush has been doing. And you see now this headline in today's USA Today, Sue Kirchhoff and Barbara Hagenbaugh, savings enter negative territory for the first time since the Great Depression. U.S. consumers spent more than they earned in 2005, resulting in a negative rate of savings for the first time since the Great Depression, the government reported. Savings as a percentage of income fell to a minus 5% in 2005. First time it's been negative since 1933. Do you get what's happening? And the only reason the people have been able to spend is because they've been taking money out of their homes. And, you know, that bubble looks like it's about to burst. And is Bush going to borrow our way out? I don't know. They're going to have to raise the debt ceiling, another $800 billion coming up sometime in the next 2 or 3 months. I see a whole lot of things converging in March that make me very nervous economically. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Number 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
David Michael Green in the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York writes, Bush is at war with Americanism. Once America stood as a proud beacon for human rights. Now we are known for the horrors of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, extraordinary rendition and torture. Once we stood four square for the rule of law, now we demolish inconvenient agreements we once promoted. The Geneva Accords, nuclear non-proliferation, the ABM treaties, the International Criminal Court, and thereby encourage others to follow suit. Once America's word was good. Today, after deceits ranging from WMD to promised but withdrawn UN votes to shameful lies about former football star Pat Tillman's death in Afghanistan, we are distrusted. Once, writes David Michael Green, America stood tall against colonialism. Today, with invasion excuses falling like dominoes, most of the world sees us as just another old-fashioned imperialist predator. Once, we stood for due process of law. Now our president creates his own prisons and courts and denies the accused long sacred rights to habeas corpus, an attorney, a speedy trial judged by peers, knowledge of the crime charged, and more. Once we are a model for civil liberties. Now Mr. Bush authorizes himself to conduct illegal wiretaps on Americans while his government monitors everyone from vegans to Quakers and snoops in libraries to see what we're reading. Once we stood for press reform. Now our tax dollars pay to plant stories and buy off journalists here and abroad while our president plots to blow up Al Jazeera, all in the name of bringing freedom to the Middle East. Once we were a good neighbor. Today, our 5% of the world population produces 25% of global warming emissions while the president scuttles the Kyoto Protocol. What has happened to America? In the meantime, as David K. Johnson notes in today's New York Times, new government data indicate that the concentration of corporate wealth among the highest income Americans grew significantly in 2003. This is the most recent year for which we have statistics. They just came out. In 2003, the top 1% of households owned 57.5% of corporate wealth, up from 53.4% the year before. The top group share of corporate wealth has grown by half since 1991, when it was 38.7%. You get this? The top 1% used to own 1991. What is that? 15 years ago. The top 1%, 15 years ago, owned 38.7% of our corporate wealth. Today, well, in 2003, 57.5%, more than half of this country. Of this country's corporate wealth, which is one of the standard measures of wealth here. The poorest fifth of Americans, that's the top 1%. The bottom 20% of Americans owned 0.6% of corporate wealth in 2003, down from 1.4% in 1991. The poor are getting poorer, the rich are getting richer. This technique for measuring wealth, he notes in the New York Times, has long been used as a standard in standard economic studies. Long-term capital gains in 1997, we're taxed at 28% and at 20% until 2003 when rates were cut to 15%. The top rate on dividends was cut to 15% from 35% that year. Meanwhile, Exxon posts another record profit. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. Political heat may rise as industry earnings soar net. Now, this is, leftover after expenses. Profits net of $80,842 a minute Exxon is making. Its net income surged to $10.71 billion, up 27% from $8.42 billion a year earlier, and 8% above Exxon's third quarter result of $9.92 billion, which was a company record. Exxon has now shown a profit greater than any company in the history of the planet. Amazing. Nicole in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Nicole, welcome to the program. And thank you for holding. Nicole, you're live and on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I have an idea. Last night I was almost in tears. I did the same thing everybody that listens to you guys. I called the senators. I did everything. And I had this epiphany. We're not thinking like the enemy. We need to come at this. I think that we've become complacent. We have a defeatist attitude because we don't have the numbers. And we need to start looking at waking up America. There are more of us than there are of them in reality.
Yeah.
Maybe if we come up with different names for things, Democratic Party tends to have it upsets it. It's got a name that's not really. It doesn't make you feel good right now.
Mm.
Come up with a different name. Democracy First. Something. Maybe these politicians that are standing up for us, the Kennedys and the Kerrys. Maybe they could bond together and for just a minute, walk away from their own personal politics and bond together, and we could do some grassroots things and come up with some different ideas, because they don't play by the rules.
Yeah, well, Nicole, I understand where you're coming from.
There are no set rules. They've made it perfectly clear there are no set rules.
The Republicans. Yeah, or that if they don't like the rules, they'll simply blow them up with a nuclear
action. So why can't we do the same thing?
Well, because we're Americans. Because we believe in the United States of America.
Well,
because we believe in the rule of law.
I don't mean breaking laws. I mean starting new crap.
But they're breaking the laws. I mean, George W. Bush has admitted to a high crime and misdemeanor. to a crime worthy of impeachment. He has not only did he confess it, but once he figured out that he had confessed a crime, he started bragging about it in an effort to try to blow it back in people's face. Yeah, and he's going to brag about it tonight. Nicole, I don't think that we need new ideas. I think what we need to do is return to the roots of the Democratic Party.
But once you know your enemy, you could work around him. We know he's listening to us. We know he's in our computers. We know he's watching us. We know everything he's doing to us. Now, if you take it the next step and you work around it, once you know someone's watching you, you can work around it. You can take it to the next step.
I think that's why we just need to be absolutely honest and upfront about what we're all about.
That's
what we're all
exactly
about is keeping the environment clean, providing a good social safety net, keeping Social Security strong, strengthening Medicare, providing health insurance, national health insurance for every American as a right, not as a privilege, the same as public education is a right in the United States. I mean, just some very simple and straightforward stuff that polls very well, by the way, Nicole. You still there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my point is, if we simply go back to the roots of the Democratic Party and start promoting the things that Harry Truman was promoting and Franklin Roosevelt was promoting, we'd like the middle class back. Thank you very much. We would like to see an opportunity for people in poverty to get out of poverty, and that means going beyond simply saying, here's a welfare check. That means things like making higher education available to everybody, free college educations to anybody who can get into a college. I mean, who has demonstrated the commitment to it, the intellectual capacity and the commitment to it. Just going back to just foundational core things. I don't think that we need to reinvent any of this stuff. It's just Democrats need to start talking like Democrats again.
I also think that as far as you shouldn't go by, well, this state supported and this state didn't.
Yeah.
You should say, okay, this person didn't. You should hold the person accountable. And the more people that rally around and say, I am a Democrat, and I don't, okay, Maria Cantwell, you did not support it when it mattered. And I'm from Washington, but people in New York should be mad that Maria Cantwell.
Well, frankly, I disagree with you on that, Nicole. And here's the reason why, if I may.
We shouldn't be separated by state. We should be all together.
I think that Maria Cantwell is not serving in a leadership role in the Senate. She's not like Harry Reid. I agree with you that you in Washington State, me in Oregon, we have a right to call Harry Reid and say, you represent us as well as the people in Nevada because you're the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. But if the reality is that the majority of voters in the state of Washington want Maria Cantwell to vote to have Sam Alito on the court, that's what she should do regardless of her party. And I mean that's the funny thing here. It's like, and one of the reason why very rarely do I have these people on the radio program is because you try to get around the weasel stuff, and ultimately it comes down to you, the elected officials, they should be there representing their constituents, period. And the job of an elected representative is to represent, it's not to lead, and we need to just make that very clear to them. And if the people of Washington want what Maria Cantwell just did, then that's the prerogative of the people of Washington. On the other hand, if they don't, I suspect there'll be some changes. And by the way, I would recommend anybody in Washington or anywhere else in the country, but in the case of Washington, for example, since you brought it up and you're in Seattle, Patty Murray voted to maintain the filibuster. That was good. Call 888-355-3588 and thank Patty Murray's office. Just say, please thank the senator for standing up for us when it counted. Because it's rare. Only 25 senators were willing to stand up for us when it counted. Only about half the Democrats. A little more than half the Democrats. I mean, that's a good step, but it's only a little more than half the Democrats. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Brother Tom, I got a real interesting factoid for you for the cult member Republicans out there that think they're conservatives. Their boy in the White House, he holds the record now of the amount of jobs lost, good paying middle class with health benefits since he's been in. And guess what?
What?
Guess what percent of them, those good paying jobs that pay over $40,000 a year with health benefits, what percent do you think what that were lost were...
You're going to have to tell me quick, Armin, because the music is going to cut us off in a second.
100% of them were private sector.
100% were in private sector. There you go. And, yeah, George W. Bush, the king of job loss.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Have a nice day. Have a nice day.
And now the next one has posted the record profit for all of history. It looks like in a couple of days here, Shell is going to announce a profit of an estimated $23 billion for 2005. British Petroleum looking at a $21.7 billion profit. And to top it off, Dell says they're going to hire 5,000 people. Yes, the economy is getting good. Dell Computer is going to hire 5,000 people in India. Yep, the Round Rock, Texas-based company is going to hire 700 to 1,000 workers for a new call center in Gurgaon, a satellite town in the capital of New Delhi. The company plans to double the staff at its product testing center in Bangalore. Some 10,000 people are already employed by Dell in India, even though they only account for 4% of the computer market in India. It's cheap labor. It's cheap labor. And Michael Dell is a good supporter of George W. Bush. Alan in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program. Alan? Nope, Alan is gone. Okay, Margaret in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Margaret, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you had talked about Homeland Security building detention camps in the United States.
Well, we certainly have them at Guantanamo Bay, or do you mean something beyond that?
Yes. Halliburton was awarded a $385 million contract to build detention centers here in the United States, and it's to supplement or to support the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and it says that it is in the event of an emergency influx of immigrants into the U.S. or to support the rapid development of new programs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they may also provide personnel, housing for ICE personnel performing law enforcement functions in support of relief efforts.
Suddenly the music from the 60s song, They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha, is running
through
my brain.
Right, with all with what they're doing to people who speak out against Bush now. What are these really for, and how can we find out? How can we stop it?
Well, I think that what we have to do, we need to keep our eyes open and keep vigilant, but what we have to do is to acquire as much political power as we can, as quickly as we can, which means getting active and getting out there and getting politically active, you know, and waking people up, Margaret. That's, and, you know, to the things like what you're talking about, and beyond that, I mean, the larger issues as well. Although that may, you know, it's not inconceivable that could become a very large issue. Hitler built his first concentration camp in Oranienburg, which almost nobody even knows, you know, it's just a little town, little concentration
mm-hmm.
camp, within a few months of becoming chancellor. And, you know, it just kind of slowly grew over the next few years, 3 or 4 years. They slowly built labor camps around the country, and until one day it was like, hey, what happened? And, you know, it's let's just hope and pray that doesn't happen here in the United States. Margaret, thanks for the call. Casey in Seattle. Hey, Casey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call really quick and just let you know that the people of Washington most certainly did not want her to vote that way.
Maria Cantwell?
Yes, and I've already called twice. And just said...
Called who?
Oh, called, I'm sorry, Senator Cantwell.
I see.
Just to ask, you know, if you don't support us, like, how do you expect us to support you?
Yeah.
I don't understand, so...
Yeah, I don't understand either. I just, you know, what... I can, you know, you can see it with some of these folks with something like CAFTA, for example, where, you know, there are some states... well, here in the Pacific Northwest, for example, you've got some states where there's, you know, big timber interests, and,
right.
and they can make good money by exporting lumber out of the United States, and so they want CAFTA, and they're big campaign contributors, and they actually represent a lot of jobs, and you can even make an argument that the majority of the people in a state might like CAFTA. You know, in some states, it's good for some states, it's bad for other states. I think it's bad for the United States, but as I said earlier, you know, Maria Cantwell's job is not to represent the United States, it's to represent the state of Washington.
Exactly.
And so, you know, with something like CAFTA, she's in favor of that, if that's what the people of Washington want, I understand, and I'm not going to criticize her for that. You know, I mean, I I don't like it, but if she's representing the people of her state, God bless her. Even if she disagrees with me on an issue, if that's what her constituents want, that's what she should be doing. But I just find it hard to believe that her constituents want Sam Alito on the court. And in fact, she voted no to put Sam Alito on the court. But first, she voted no for the filibuster, and it's like, you know, it's talking out of both sides of your mouth. I'm baffled.
I totally don't get it. So I just don't even want, I'm not going to, you know, re-vote for her, because that was the point, to do something.
Yeah, what constituency could she possibly be trying to satisfy with that? I mean, I'm truly baffled, and I hope that, you know, maybe somebody from her staff will call, or somebody who understands.
I left my address, because I was like, no, I really want an answer. Like, I just completely, me and my kids just got screwed along with everyone else, and I believe that we deserve to at least know an answer. Like,
yeah.
People are bureaucrats, or they're patriots. Like, which one?
I agree.
All right.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call.
No problem.
And it's not just Maria Cantwell. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of them that owe us an answer on this. Alan in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Alan, welcome to the Alan dropped off again. I think Alan's cell phone is flaky here. David in Bainbridge Island. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi. Listen, Tom, I didn't hear you mention Bob Casey.
Bob Casey is the big-name Democrat that I was referring to versus Santorum.
I didn't hear it. I've already sent some money to him, and I think it would help if every state where there is a chance of unseating a Republican, you would announce that and possibly even give a phone number and address so that we could send contributions to those people.
Well, we'll be posting those things on our message board over at TomHartman.com. The message board, by the way, is down right now. We're moving it over to another server over yesterday and today.
The latest polls are that Casey's leading Santorum. And I never heard of the other people that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, you know, Unknown Democrat would be leading Santorum right now. I mean, the people in Pennsylvania figured out what Tricky Ricky is up to.
Well, isn't Casey a Democrat?
Yeah, Casey is a Democrat.
An Iraqi, a war veteran.
Yes, and a conservative.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, which is astounding. But and in fact, according to this most recent poll done by Zogby, this Zogby poll, when if a progressive were running against Santorum, they would score even better. They would beat him even more handily. David, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. In fact, we got to wrap up the show. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program tomorrow is the government using spy chips on us. Liz McIntyre, the author of Spy Chips, will elaborate. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org will expose the shortchanging of our veterans in the VA State of the Union. Mark Wilson is running against Maria Cantwell in Washington Democratic primary. Will be here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism starts with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.